Ewan didn't say anything else. The camp was a bustle of activity. There were 12 Queen's Guards, 8 soldiers who had come in with General Hall, and then several more men who had come with the man from Mortmain. Elston and Kib were cooking the deer, and the air was heavy with the smell of roasting meat. The rest of the men milled around the fire like hungry vultures. Ewan heard snatches of conversation as he and Bradshaw walked the perimeter. The Queen, the Mort Rebellion, something about an orphan. Ewan knew of no orphans among the guard, though now that Dar was dead, he supposed he was an orphan himself. On another day he might have asked Bradshaw, but now he thought it best to stay quiet.
"You too,"
the mace barked.
"Over here."
Ewan and Bradshaw followed him to the tent at the center of the camp. Inside, the small folding table was covered with maps and surrounded by chairs from the just-finished meeting. As the mace sat down, Ewan saw that he had dark circles around his eyes. Normally, Ewan would not even dare guess what the mace was thinking, but now he thought he knew. The first night out of New London they had ridden hard, and so it was not until dawn that the mace had noticed Isha missing. The entire guard had taken the news badly, though none so badly as Venner, who pitched what Dar would have called a fit, cursing and throwing things from his saddlebags. The mace did not say a word, but his silence frightened Ewan. He had worried that the mace might blame him or blame Bradshaw. After all, they had been the last to see her. But no one said anything, and gradually Ewan realized that he was not in trouble.
"We need to do this quickly,"
the mace said.
"Sit down."
They sat.
"Le Vieux confirms that the Queen is still in the Palais dungeons, but we cannot enter Mortmain via the Argive. General Hall tells me that a legion of Mort remained behind to hold the eastern end of the pass. They mean to regulate traffic from now on. So we will be moving straight east, crossing over the border hills."
Not all of this made sense to Ewan, but he nodded anyway, following Bradshaw's lead.
"You two will not be going with us."
Bradshaw drew an angry breath, but Ewan merely waited. He hoped he was not to be sent home, for he loved it out here. In the keep, he could not help thinking of Dar, who had worked in the dungeons for his entire life. The mace frowned.
"Andalai's little one is only 3 years old, and I'm not a man to base strategy around a child's dreams, but the fact remains that Glee is often correct."
"She does have a gift," Bradshaw ventured.
"This is my dilemma. Le Vieux says that the Queen is in the Palais dungeons. He saw her there himself, and I trust his word. Glee says the Queen is in Jin Reach, and Andalai tells me that Glee is correct. So what am I to do?"
"Where is Jin Reach, sir?" Bradshaw asked.
"It's a tiny village in the southern Almont, just north of the drylands, a way station for fools who mean to cross the open desert and try to get into Kader without paying the king's tolls. There can't be more than 200 souls in the town, and I don't know what the queen would ever be doing there. But all the same..."
The mace's voice trailed off. "You must cover your bases," Bradshaw supplied.
"Yes. As strange as it sounds, I want the two of you to go down to Jin Reach and simply keep your eyes open. Look for anything out of the ordinary."
The mace rustled through his saddlebags and tossed Bradshaw a bag of coin.
"That should keep you in a good room for 3 weeks. If nothing happens and you see nothing, then come home."
"What if we see something?"
"Then use your judgment. Our priority is the Queen. If we recover her, we mean to head for the keep as soon as possible, and we won't have time to come looking for you down in the dry lands. If anything should happen, send word back to this camp. Several of the guard and most of Hall's people will stay here.
Ewan didn't like the sound of this errand. It seemed as though they would be all alone in a tiny village in the desert. Bradshaw might have magic, but neither of them knew how to wield a sword.
You'll leave tonight, quietly, after dinner. Follow the irrigation system off the Crythe. A good night's ride and a bit due south should see you down to Gin Reach.
How will we know it?
Ewan asked.
By asking, I suppose. Bradshaw is in charge.
Bradshaw looked surprised by this, and Ewan was too. Isha had told Ewan that the mace didn't like magic, though Ewan didn't understand why. Surely the world was better when unusual things could happen.
I'm going to trust you, magician, though I trust none of your ilk.
Bradshaw shrugged. The queen did me a good turn, captain. I will do her one, if I can.
Dismissed.
The two men wandered out of the tent. Ewan had the feeling that Bradshaw was just as surprised as he was. Bradshaw could do many amazing things. Perhaps that was why the mace had chosen him. But after thinking about it for a moment, Ewan was fairly sure that the mace didn't expect anything to happen to them at all.
Pack yourself up, Bradshaw told him. I'll see about food and water.
Ewan nodded and went to find his horse. From the noise around the campfire, he could tell that the deer was finally ready, but he had lost his appetite. He had been terrified of the very notion of Mortmain, the wicked kingdom that Dar spoke of in all his fairy tales. But at the same time, he had been proud to be chosen to venture there. He knew he was not smart enough to be a queen's guard, and he had been ready to bow out and go on the hunt for the witch, Brenna. There was honor in that. But this mission did not feel real. As he neared the horses, he saw a solitary figure, Pen, sitting alone facing east on one of the rocks that bordered the corral. More than once, Ewan had heard others in the guard say that Pen was the queen's favorite, and he had noticed that Pen did not seem himself since the queen had left. Ewan thought it best not to talk to Pen, so he merely dug through the pile until he found his saddles and saddlebags, then took them over to his horse. Ewan was not a good rider. He had learned with his brothers when he was young, but he'd never taken to it the way Peter and Arthur had. Bradshaw was not much of a rider either, and the two of them had often lagged behind on this journey, hurrying to catch up while the others rested. Now they were being sent away, off to some place Ewan had never heard of. His horse, Van, stared at him, almost as though he understood, and Ewan stroked Van's neck for a long moment. It was one thing to go to Mortmain himself, another to drag an animal there. At least Van would be out of danger as well. When he slung his saddlebags over the horse's back, his grey guard cloak fell to the ground. They hadn't been allowed to wear their cloaks on this journey, but Ewan had brought his anyway. It was the dearest item he owned, though he understood that it had never really belonged to him. He went to the mace's horse, folded the cloak and draped it over the mace's saddle. Ewan? Pen was beckoning him over. Ewan touched the cloak one last time, and then went to Pen. As he neared, he saw that Pen's eyes were red, as though he'd been crying.
You're going to Gin Reach?
Ewan nodded.
I don't think you'll find anything there, and neither does the captain.
If you do. Pen was silent for a long moment. If you do. You're Queen's Guard now. A real Queen's Guard, you understand? You protect the Queen, no matter the cost to yourself. Ewan was too bewildered to do anything but nod, and Pen clapped him on the shoulder. Draw me some pictures while you're down there. When we all get back to the keep, we'll sit and have another look through your portfolio. Ewan smiled. Pen had been the first one to tell him that his pile of pictures had a name. Luck to you, Ewan. And you? Ewan replied. As Pen walked away, he tried to puzzle out what Pen had said. Queen's guards were supposed to lay down their lives to protect the Queen, and Ewan understood that. But Pen seemed to be talking about something different. Bradshaw was approaching the corral now, a heavy pack over one shoulder. Ewan waited for him, still considering Penn's words. There was a word for these things. It danced right on the edge of Ewan's mind for a moment before he retrieved it. Sacrifice. That was what it was for Pen. Being a Queen's Guard was a matter of sacrifice. And from the look of him, it was hurting him badly. Ewan hesitated for a moment longer, and then, not quite knowing why, he grabbed his grey cloak from the mace's saddle and stuffed it back into his own saddlebag. Javel woke to shouting. The voice was a woman's, and for a moment he was confused until he remembered where he was. In the keep. He had ridden hard for 3 days, with only brief breaks to water his horse, and at the moment he put the mace's letter into Devin's hand, he had not cared whether the man believed him or not, had only felt great thanksgiving that the ride was done. Now a man was shouting. Javel sat up in bed, scrubbed a palm across his face, and found at least 4 days' growth of beard. He had been asleep for some time. The argument continued to rage outside, unintelligible but rancorous, and Javel sighed and grabbed his boots. When he emerged into the hallway, he found it lined with Queen's guards. The guard in charge, Devin, was squared off with a tall, dark-haired woman just outside Javel's door. Javel did not recognize the woman, but he marked how hard the rest of the Queen's guard were working not to look at her. Their gazes fixed on the floor or the ceiling or anything else. "I tell you, they are coming," the woman shouted at Devin.
"Come down, Enderley. You'll weak the wing."
"Good. We must get out of here. Now." Devin glanced at the men around him, his face reddening.
"Are you giving me an order?"
"Yes, you great ass. Get these people out of bed."
"Shut up."
The voice echoed down the hallway. On Javel's right, a new figure emerged from one of the rooms farther down the corridor, and this was someone Javel did recognize. Arliss, one of the biggest bookmakers and dealers in New London. If a man spent any amount of time drinking in the gut, and Javel, of course, had spent plenty, he could not fail to encounter Arliss's ubiquitous, gnome-like figure, in and out of various pubs, wheeling and dealing, making money hand over fist.
"This had better be good," Arliss growled. "I'm trying to resettle nearly 100,000 people who still don't want to leave. The provisioning alone would make you cry."
The woman, Anderley, said, "We must leave. Now. Immediately."
"To go where?"
"Anywhere." she replied flatly.
The woman had a nightmare, Devon told him. I will clear this up, sir. Never mind.
But Devon's voice had weakened, and he would not look directly at Andalai either. Even Javel could feel the aura of strangeness around her, her eyes so distant that they seemed to see beyond this world. The group of Queen's guards shuffled uncomfortably, looking from Devon to Arliss.
Andalai?
Arliss asked. The Holy Father's people are coming here now. We must get out of here.
I warned you, Andalai.
Devon lowered his voice, for now doors were beginning to open up and down the hallway.
Get yourself back to your children.
I will not, Andalai replied coldly. The mace put you in charge of the guard, not of me.
How do you propose the Holy Father means to enter the keep? He has no soldiers.
Yes, he does. The Mort.
The Mort are gone.
No. She's right, said a younger guard. Javel vaguely remembered him from that long, dreamlike trip back from the Argive. He could not be more than 20. There was a bow slung across his back. Andalai always knows. We must get out of here.
Shut up, Wilmer,
Devon snapped. At the same moment, a thundering blow shook the floor beneath their feet. Javel cried out, and he was not alone.
A ram,
Arliss muttered.
Too late.
Devon grabbed one of the guards.
Find out what's happening down there.
The guard disappeared. Javel watched him go, picturing the scene at the gate below. The gate guard would be scrambling to bolster the doors, to pull the drawbridge. They knew how to repel invaders. It was part of the standard training for a gate guard. But if there were too many people on the bridge, it would not rise, and the gates, while strong iron, would not hold forever against a steel ram. Even the moat was not deep enough to act as an impediment. If Vil was still in charge of the gate guard, he would be down there, calm and competent as ever, directing men as they bricked the gate and strained to raise the bridge. But if the attacking force was large enough, every guard on the gate would know that these were holding actions only. Arliss turned to Devon.
What about the mace's back way out? The tunnels?
I don't know them,
Devon replied, looking shamefaced.
He never told me.
Andalai?
She shook her head. Another blow shook the walls around them, and Javel blinked as grit silted down from the ceiling into his eyes.
Have the Mort invaded again? Devon demanded. How could we not know?
It's no invasion, Andalai replied. This is the Arvath. Javel felt a tug on his trouser leg and looked down to find a small girl staring up at him. She was tiny, little more than a toddler, but her eyes were strangely adult. Javel tried to ignore her, but she kept on tugging, her small face determined, and finally he bent down and asked,
"What is it, child?"
Gate guard,
the girl whispered, and her voice did not match her age either. The tone was mocking, somehow familiar.
Yes.
You might still be useful.
Javel recoiled, but the child had already released his leg. She toddled over to the woman, Andalai, and climbed up into her arms. They stared at each other for a long moment, as though speaking, and a shudder worked its way up Javel's spine. For the past few days he had been riding too hard to even think of drink, but in that moment he would have given anything for a shot of whiskey, perhaps 10. A rhythmic thrumming echoed beneath their feet, and Arliss shook his head.
The gate won't hold forever. We have to barricade the wing.
Andalai nodded. We need furniture.
The heavy pieces.
Thinking of the heavy armoire in his room, Javel headed back there, but he paused in the doorway, struck by the pitiful pile of belongings at the foot of the bed. He had brought only a few things with him to Mortmain, preferring to leave their house just as it was, so that when Ali came home, she would see that nothing had changed. The idea made him smile now, but it was a smile full of winter. His old life was gone, wiped away, and the sad, half-full state of his baggage seemed to prove it.
Gate guard.
The girl's voice, Dyer's voice, echoed inside his head. I was, Javel replied, almost absently. He had been a gate guard for more than 10 years, and a decent one. Going to a job every day, a job that needed doing, and performing it competently, there had been an honor in that. But a man eaten up by his past mistakes could not see it. Javel bent to his baggage, picked up his sword and stared at it for a long moment, feeling as though he stood on the edge of a precipice.
Useful.
He turned and strode down the hallway into the great open room that housed the Queen's empty throne. When he turned the corner, he saw the guard preparing to barricade the great double doors with heavy furniture, several pieces already grouped on the far wall.
Hold! Javel shouted. Let me pass!
You don't want to go out there, Devon told him. There's a mob, at least 200 plus the mort.
I'm a gate guard, Javel replied. Let me pass.
Your funeral.
Devon knocked 4 times on the door, then raised the bar and opened it wide enough for Javel to slip through.
We can't let you back in, Devon called after him.
Right, Javel muttered, increasing his pace. The sound of the ram was much louder out here, a steady thudding that shook the walls. More dust drifted down from the ceiling, a light snowfall in the torchlight. As Javel descended the stairs, the thudding increased until it was strong enough to make his teeth clatter, each blow punctuated by the metallic clang of wood on iron. Part of Javel, the weak part that always retreated into the shadows of the pub, wanted to turn around, to run right back upstairs.
No, he whispered, trying to convince himself, I can still be useful.
When he reached the first floor, he ran down the main hallway, passing several wide-eyed keep servants along the way.
Sir, what's happening?
An old woman demanded.
Siege, he replied. Make for the upper floors and hide.
She fled. Javel came around the final corner and found the gate guard preparing to brick the gate. This was a contingency for which they all prepared, and a small storeroom was kept just off the gatehouse for this purpose. Guards moved back and forth from the storeroom, carrying piles of bricks, and several more were already laying a triple layer of bricks and mortar behind the barricade. Javel was relieved to recognize 2 of them, Martin and Vil. As he approached, Vil straightened, holding a trowel.
Javel? What's happening?
Javel shouted. The blows of the ram were so loud out here that they seemed to make his spine shudder.
They came out of nowhere, Vil replied, shouting as well. We dropped the gate, but we didn't have time to get the bridge up. The gate won't hold unless we brick.
Javel nodded.
Give me work, Vil. I thought you were with the Queen's Guard.
I'm a gate guard, Javel shouted back. Give me work!
Vil stared at him, measuring for a long moment, then said,
I could use another man to mix mortar. Gil's already in the storeroom. Go!
Javel nodded, smiling, for in this simple order he felt somehow blessed. He belted his sword to his waist, stepped lightly over Martin's back, and went to work. Isha crouched in the shadows of a recess, her hand on her knife. She was filthy, covered in the grime of the tunnels, and she could smell herself, a mixture of long congealed sweat and the rotten dampness that seemed to rain down here. Her arm throbbed dully from a long scratch she had taken yesterday, but the song of the fight was upon her. Her blood coursed with it. Merritt stood behind her. And across the tunnel, in another recess, were the Miller brothers, barely visible in the thin torchlight. Daniel's neck was wrapped and bandaged. He had taken a terrible burn when he surprised a woman who was cooking chicken in a pot of boiling oil. She had thrown the pot at him, and then tried to flee with her charges, two boys and three girls, all under the age of 10. They had managed to save the children, removing them to the large holding area up in the gut. But the woman had fled into the dark. Another of the handlers, a man, had tried to club Christopher with a shovel, and ended up with the shovel buried in his ribs. Isha didn't know whether the Miller brothers were typical Caden or not, and she no longer cared. She meant to join them, or die trying. But that dream was still years away. The first step, the one she could accomplish now, was to have them treat her as though she were anyone else, a tool to be wielded. Christopher leaned into the light, pointing to Isha. Merritt poked her in the back. "That's you, girl. Give us another good show." Isha tucked her knife into the back of her trousers, covering it with her shirt tail. She took a deep breath and darted out into the main tunnel. It was a wide bore, perhaps 20 feet from side to side, and another 20 to the arch of the ceiling over her head. Water seeped through the cracks and dripped down to form wide puddles on the floor. Isha thought they must be somewhere near the keep moat, perhaps even underneath it. Ahead, the tunnel branched into three passages, each leading into darkness. Down one of these three passages were several men, a pimp and his clients, holding at least 10 children. Isha and the 4 Caden had been tracking them for more than a day in this underground labyrinth. The upper levels were lit by scattered but consistent torchlight. Down here, there was none but what they brought themselves. Isha held her torch higher, but she could see nothing of the 3 passages beyond their entrances, vast black mouths opening into more dark.
"Hello?" she called. "Is anybody there?"
Silence. But Isha could feel eyes upon her. She tottered forward, wrapping one arm around herself in the manner of a cold child. In the 5 days she had been down there, she had seen many children, both living and dead. James had explained to her in a quiet, matter-of-fact voice that some pimps chose to slaughter their stables so that the children could neither implicate them nor slow them down in flight.
"Hello?" she called again. "Mrs. Evans?"
They had put Mrs. Evans under arrest 3 days ago, and she was now being held at the New London jail. She had not gone easily. It was she who'd given Isha the knife wound on her arm. But her name was very useful, for she seemed to be well known in the creche, and no one knew that she'd been arrested. Isha had already pulled this trick successfully 2 times.
"Mrs. Evans? I'm hungry."
She sensed movement ahead, but could not tell which tunnel it came from. Fear welled within her, but adrenaline was stronger. It was the song of the fight, yes, but there was something else at work here. Isha was doing something important. She didn't know whether the Caden would have accepted her if they hadn't had use for a child, dangling bait to draw out the difficult prey. But it no longer mattered. She was helping. Helping to save the weak and punish those who needed punishment. The song of the fight was a great thing in itself, but the song of the righteous fight was exponentially more powerful, allowing Isha to ignore her fear and limp forward a few more feet.
Hello?
The shadowy form of a man emerged from the left-hand tunnel. Isha blinked up at him. Instinct told her to give the alarm, but she held silent. When they spooked the prey would panic, and that made them more likely to kill the children.
"Mrs. Evans left me," she told the man, pitching her voice high for the Caden behind her.
He smiled. She could see the white of his teeth in the dim light, but the rest of him was a large shadow, holding out a hand. This was the most difficult part for Isha. She would have liked nothing better than to lop his hand off at the wrist. But there were more than 10 children down that tunnel. The man could not be given the chance to scream. She took his hand, grimacing inwardly at the sweaty feel of his skin. The man took the torch from her and held it high, pulling her with him into the tunnel. With her free hand, she reached behind her and grasped the hilt of her knife. The man was much taller, and it would take a movement both sharp and seamless to get the knife to his throat. The people in the creche, both adults and children, were like animals, skittish and overly sensitive to danger. Merritt said it was the result of a life lived in the shadows, but Isha wondered. She was skittish herself. They rounded a corner, and Isha found herself in a small enclosed chamber with a low ceiling, barely tall enough for the man beside her to stand up straight. The chamber itself was lit by 2 torches, but on the far wall was another door that led into blackness. The floor was covered with children, sitting cross-legged. A quick scan of the room gave Isha 14 of them. The oldest could not be more than 11. 5 more men were scattered along the walls, and Isha marked that 3 of them carried swords before she halted, dumbfounded. Her eyes locked on the 4th. Dar, staring right back at her. His eyes widened, and he opened his mouth to shout. Isha tried to jerk her hand free, but the tall man had already whirled around and thrown her against the wall. Isha went down, half dazed, and felt a bloom of pain in her chest as the man kicked her in the ribs.
"A trap!" Dar shouted. "Run!"
The children began to scream, and the echo of all those voices against the tunnel walls made Isha clap her hands to her ears. The children scrambled to their feet and rushed through the far doorway. The blows to her ribcage stopped, and Isha looked up to see the last of the men disappearing behind them. "Duh," she thought fuzzily, and she wondered why she had not expected him. Pimp or client, neither would surprise her. The 4 Caden burst into the room, swords drawn, and she pointed to the far doorway as she tried to sit up.
"You're right, girl,"
Daniel asked her.
"Fine," she wheezed. "Go. Go."
They tore through the doorway, and Isha began the slow process of dragging herself to her feet. Her ribs ached, and her head was cut open where she had hit the wall. She heard the ring of swords in the tunnel beyond and pushed herself up. The Caden could take care of themselves, but later on they might remember that she had not been there with them. "Dar, here," her mind repeated, and the thought had a sharp edge to it now. She pulled one of the torches from its bracket and cast around until she found her knife lying across the room. The screams of the children were muted now, growing distant, With her knife in one hand and a torch in the other, Isha took a deep breath, feeling something pull at her ribs, and charged after them. The tunnel was narrower on this side, and soon it began to wind, snake-like, ever upward. Ahead, she heard a man shouting. And then there was only the scuffling of her own feet. The closeness increased until Isha would have given anything for a breath of fresh air. She thought she was gaining on them, but could not be sure. Her head ached. Every few seconds she had to wipe blood from her eyes. She skidded around a turn and came to a halt. At her feet lay a man's body. She crept closer, then used her foot to roll him over. Da, still breathing. He too had taken a blow to the head. She could see the beginnings of an ugly bruise on his temple. Isha squatted and placed the torch on the floor, her knife held at the ready in case it was a trick. But Da lay still, hoarse breath hissing in and out through his black beard. "I could kill you now," Isha whispered, brandishing her knife before Dar's closed eyes. "I could cut your throat, and no one would care. I could say I was defending myself." And it would be true, she realized. She couldn't even imagine how it would feel to walk the earth knowing that Dar was no longer doing the same. To know that she no longer had a lurking enemy out there, a danger to them all. That would be freedom indeed. Isha had never killed anyone before. But if she was going to start, she could hardly make a better choice than this. Still she hesitated, clutching her knife as her knees began to ache and her palms became sticky with sweat. "Why?" she whispered, watching Dar's eyelids twitch. "Why did you have to be this way?" Even more than she wanted to kill Dar, she wanted answers, wanted to call him to account. Killing him seemed far too easy, particularly when he was unconscious. It was no punishment. Several childish shrieks echoed up the hallway, making Isha jump. For a moment she had forgotten why she was here, the children. One day, less than a year ago, she had walked into the kitchen and found Dar with his hand up Glee's dress. And Glee not 3 years old. "Too easy," she muttered. "Just too easy." The Caden had the manacles, but she didn't know when they would be back. Using her knife, Isha cut the sleeves from Dar's shirt, being careful not to touch him. She wrapped his wrists and ankles, tying the knots as securely as she could. Dar stirred and groaned as she tightened the bonds, but his eyes remained closed, and Isha stared down at him for a long moment, wishing she were older, old enough to get past it all. Someone was coming back up the tunnel now, and Isha straightened, raising her knife. But as the noise resolved itself into many footsteps, walking at a steady pace, she relaxed and slipped the knife out of sight. The other part of her job was about to begin, and she was determined to do it well. The group of children came around the corner, followed by all four Caden holding torches. Christopher and James were each hauling a prisoner as well, men whose faces had been badly beaten. The children were frightened. Many of them were crying, and they looked fearfully up at the four red-cloaked men. Isha held up her hands. "Listen to me," she said. "These men are good men. They're here to help you, I swear it. We're going to take you out of the tunnels." She said this last as gently as possible, for they had already discovered that this news alarmed the children more than anything else. Many of them had lived their entire lives down here, and had no concept of the world above.
"We have plenty of food,"
Isha continued, and saw their eyes brighten with interest.
"We'll get sick if we go up the stairs,"
one of the older girls announced.
"My pa said so."
"Your pa lied,"
Isha told her, glancing down at Dar, whose chest still rose and fell in the easy rhythm of unconsciousness.
"I have lived up there my entire life."
The girl still looked faintly mutinous, but said nothing else.
"You should follow us, and stay together. If you stray, you may get lost down here in the dark."
For the first few days, this possibility had haunted Isha as well, but Daniel always marked the walls well with special chalk that did not dissolve under the drip of water. As long as they didn't run out of light, they were fine. Christopher had bent to Dar now, examining his bonds.
"I'll have to teach you to tie a knot, girl. If he'd woken, he would have been out of this in seconds."
"If he'd woken, I would have killed him."
But Isha didn't say it. She didn't want to alarm the children, but even more, she didn't want the Caden to know Dar was her father. Corin had told her that the Caden, like the guard, allowed new recruits to wipe their past clean. But she didn't know what status she really held with them. And besides, did that leeway include a past as ugly as this? Christopher snapped a pair of manacles on Dar's wrists before hoisting him to his feet. Dar's eyes opened, bleary and red, and they wandered the room for a moment before finding Isha and locking on her.
"Want to do the honors?"
Daniel asked. Meeting his eyes, Isha froze, because she saw that he already knew. They all knew. It was the audience, the damnable audience, where she had revealed her shame to the entire world. Merritt was looking at her with poorly concealed pity, and James had put a hand on her shoulder.
"Go ahead,"
he murmured.
"That will do you good."
Isha took a deep breath. The children's faces calmed her, reminded her of how much was at stake here, and her own shame receded. She did not even need to dig for the words. She had heard them so many times in the past week that they were right there, within easy reach.
"In the name of Her Majesty, Queen Kelsey Glynn, you men are under arrest for pandering, trafficking, and facilitation of assault. You will be held in the New London Jail until such time as you account for yourselves before a judge. You will not be harmed further unless you attempt to escape."
"Come on,"
Daniel said brusquely.
"Let's get them topside. You keep an eye on the children, girl. Make sure they don't stray."
They started back the way they had come. James and Christopher in the front, and Isha, Merritt, and Daniel bringing up the rear. Isha's arm throbbed, and she saw that the long scratch which had sealed itself yesterday was beginning to swell beneath its reddening seam. As adrenaline wore off, the pain from this scratch became difficult to ignore, but Isha swallowed it as best she could, holding a child's hand in each of hers. After more than an hour of walking uphill, they came to a broad intersection of six tunnels. Isha recognized this place. They were only some 30 minutes from regaining the surface. Blue light filtered down, diffused through several layers of gratings, and Isha realized that up there, topside, it must be dawn already. The idea of sunlight seemed almost fanciful. Down here long enough, one forgot that there was anything more than the amber glow of torches. The children were tired. One little boy, who could not be more than 5, had begun to lag every few steps, and Isha had to lightly jerk his hand to bring him along. The entire group walked without speaking, no sound but their staggered footfalls echoing against stone. And it was this void that allowed Isha to hear a man's voice, low and urgent, somewhere behind her on the right.
"Please, God."
Isha halted. The acoustics in these tunnels were strange. Sometimes she could hear distant voices clearly enough to understand the words, while at other times she could not hear Daniel's murmured commands from 10 feet away. The voice she had just heard had been clear, with no peculiar quality of distance or dead air. The speaker must be very close.
"What is it, girl?"
Merritt asked, turning back to wait for her. "Give me your torch."
"Hold!"
he shouted to the Miller brothers, then handed his torch to Isha. Holding it high, she wandered a few feet down the tunnel, examining the walls. The intersection was now at least 100 feet behind them, and she didn't think the voice could have been so far off as that. A hidden nest, perhaps? They had found one of those already, cleverly concealed under a drainage gate. The Caden had been forced to kill the 6 men and women who ran that particular pod, but Isha counted them no loss. One woman, realizing she was cornered, had put a dagger to the throat of a young girl, little more than a toddler. But Daniel could throw a knife just as well as he could wield one, and the woman went down with the blade planted squarely in her jugular, the child not even scratched. Isha ran her fingers over the uneven surface of the tunnel, working her way backward, and her breath halted as she felt a gap in the stonework, not more than 10 inches wide.
"Light!"
she shouted up the tunnel. "More light!" The Caden ushered the children and prisoners backward, crowding close to examine the gap. It would barely admit a thin man, but would certainly admit children. Isha fancied she could hear, not with her ears perhaps, but with her mind, a rapid heartbeat on the far side of the wall. "There's someone in there," she told Merritt.
"Can you squeeze through?"
She gave him the torch. Her own heartbeat had increased, for there was certainly danger here. But she was pleased that none of them protested sending her in on her own, where they could not follow. Holding her knife in front of her, she bent down and eased through the crack. It was a squeeze, but not too tight. At any moment she expected to meet resistance, adult hands grabbing her. But nothing came. And then she was on the far side of the wall, reaching back through so that Merritt could hand her the torch.
"Be on your guard, child,"
Daniel called outside. Isha held the torch high, looking around. She was in a narrow room, almost a tunnel itself. The smell was much, much worse in here, enough to make her eyes water. The walls dripped with mould. Trash littered the floor, and in the near corner Isha saw what appeared to be a pile of human waste. She jumped, gasping, as a rat's thick body scuttled over her foot, and for a moment she wanted to simply flee. Flee this room and these tunnels, and run the long road back up to the keep. Her arm ached. Her mind ached. And she was only 12 years old.
"Pain."
The voice was little more than an echo deep in her mind. But still it made Isha stand up straight, for it belonged to the mace.
"Pain only disables the weak."
A killer of children, her mind returned. But that thought had no power here. What happened in the creche was worse than murder. Far worse. "Only the weak," Isha whispered to herself. "Only the weak." She held the torch higher and stepped forward, seeking the far end of the long, narrow room. And as the light hit the far wall, she halted, instinctively raising her knife. 2 men sat there, leaning against the wall, their clothing so streaked with mud and filth that it told Isha nothing. One man's eyes were closed. He appeared to be asleep, but Isha knew instinctively that he was dead. The other simply stared with wide, distant eyes. His face was smudged with mud and he was bone-thin, gaunt hollows beneath his cheekbones. His wrists looked like sticks where they emerged from his sleeves. He stared up into the light, his pupils dilating, and Isha gasped as she recognized the keep priest, Father Tyler.
"All right in there, girl,"
one of the Caden called from the tunnel outside.
"Yes."
"Well, hurry it up. These children need food and we need sleep."
The priest opened his mouth to speak, and Isha put a finger to her lips. Her mind was moving, not sluggishly as before, but lightning quick. Father Tyler, who had helped her to find books to read in the Queen's Library. The mace wanted Father Tyler returned to the keep, but had not been able to find him. The Arvath had laid a bounty on Father Tyler's head, £10,000, the last Isha had heard. Of course, the mace had laid a bounty too, but the two amounts were constantly in flux. The mace would surely match the Arvath's offer, Isha knew that. But the Caden might not. If Isha told the Caden that £10,000 lay behind this wall, would they help her return Father Tyler to the keep? Just on her say-so? Not a chance. As quietly as possible, Isha dug into the pockets of her grey cloak. She had half a loaf of bread, only 2 days old, and some dried fruit, and these she placed at Father Tyler's feet. He grabbed the bread and began to wolf it down. She produced her canteen and handed it over as well, and then, placing her fingers to her lips again, she backtracked toward the gap in the wall.
"My mistake," she called. "Rats, a good-sized nest."
"Well, get out here," James shouted, irritated. "We're tired."
Isha flattened her palm at Father Tyler, indicating that he should stay where he was, and then worked her way back into the main tunnel.
"I'm sorry," she muttered. "I thought I heard a voice."
Daniel shrugged.
"Good to check every corner. Let's get going."
For a moment in there, Isha had forgotten about Dar, but now, as she emerged, his voice echoed across the tunnel.
"Isha, girl."
She looked up, and a part of her hated herself for it, for the fact that Dar's voice was still the voice of God inside her head, impossible to ignore.
"What, Dar?"
"Surely you won't let them do this to me."
"Shut up,"
Christopher snapped, shaking Dar like a rag doll.
"I'm speaking to my daughter."
Isha stared at him, sickened. His hair was mussed, his beard soaked with blood, but beneath these things he looked just as he always had, manacles or not. Isha was suddenly frightened, for she remembered this exactly. Dar's voice, wheedling, full of slippery oil.
"Isha, you don't want to see me in jail?"
She clouted him across the face. "I'd like to see you in a hole, Dar, but prison will do for me. You'll never see any of our family again. I hope you die in the dark." She turned back to Christopher. "Do me a favor and gag him."
"Do us all a favor,"
Merritt echoed, his voice disgusted. The group of children around them stared wide-eyed at this exchange, and the little boy wormed his hand back into Isha's, staring up at her as Christopher anchored a length of cloth in Dar's mouth. The gag brought Isha no relief. She could only stand there miserably, wishing that she were the child of someone else, fighting not to look backward at the hole in the wall. She would have to come back down here, slip the Caden somehow and return with more food. Alone. Down here in the dark. The idea terrified her, but she saw no way around it. The priest must be returned to the keep. She felt much loyalty to these Caden, who had taken her in and put her to work. But her loyalty to the mace, to the queen, these were greater, and both the queen and the mace wanted Father Tyler back.
Which am I? She wondered. Caden, or a queen's guard?
She didn't know, but whichever she chose, it would be dangerous work. Her arm throbbed insistently, and when they got topside, Isha saw that the seam of her wound had begun to weep clear fluid. The surrounding flesh burned an angry shade of red.
Infected,
Isha's mind whispered, and her stomach tightened. At their little house in the lower bend, they'd had a neighbor named Mrs. Lyme who had cut herself with a dirty blade. No one in the lower bend could afford antibiotics, and Mrs. Lyme had finally simply disappeared from the landscape. Her house, standing empty until some squatters took it over. Isha had always remembered the word, which rang like a death knell in her mind. Infection. Chapter 8. The Tear Lands. My tables, meat it is, I set it down, that one may smile and smile, and be a villain. Hamlet, William Shakespeare, pre-crossing Anglo. In her more selfish moments, Katie wished only for the harvest to be over. She hated the farm, the smell of manure, the back-breaking work of picking vegetables only to reap the reward of food that would simply be eaten. She hated manual labor. Sometimes she wished that the fields would catch on fire. She was not alone. She seemed to hear complaints all around her, more than she had ever heard before, and most of it was directed toward the people at the top of the hill. Those too old or too sick to work, or parents with children too small to be left. These people were always excused from the harvest. But this year, such exemptions were causing more ill feeling than usual. Maybe Rose right, she thought, late one afternoon, when her back was screaming and her hands blistered from lugging her basket of corn down the row. Maybe none of us are selfless enough to live here. Roe and Katie had not been assigned as harvest partners this year. Roe had been stuck with Gavin on the squash patch, more than an acre away. Katie wondered if Mum had interfered to bring about this result. Lately, Katie had begun to feel as though Mum were actively working to disengage her from Roe, to keep them apart. Good luck, Mum, Katie snarled quietly, digging into the corn plants. Her friendship with Roe was very different than it had once been. Roe had never admitted what he had done that night, and between them they maintained the polite fiction that Roe had simply lost her in the dark. But they both knew that wasn't so, and the knowledge had changed their friendship irrevocably. No longer did the two of them seem bound in a magic circle, inviolate by the outside world. They were still friends, but now Katie was one of many, perhaps no more special to Roe than Gavin or Lear or anyone else. Sometimes that hurt, but not much. The memory of that night in the woods was too strong.
Did you say something? Jonathan asked, leaning around the corn stalk.
Nothing. He ducked out of sight again. Katie didn't know why they had been assigned as partners, but she could have done worse. Jonathan was a hard worker,
and he didn't disappear, as Roe so often did, when it was time to lug the full baskets back toward the warehouse. For the first few days of the harvest, Katie had waited to see if Jonathan would fall into another trance,